it was a fucking problem from day dot, I think, really. The way with my stuff, it started taking stuff away, but really, it was after my dad passed away, then it was a little bit, it was drinking to numb, really. And yeah, that was, so I'd say around 16, whereas before drinking had been sort of like with the boys and yeah, and a laugh, because I was young. I was still at school. And so it would be Bow Cemetery, a few boys, a few girls, puff, drink, like get a tenner off me mum and get a bit of half and get a couple of cans. They're all drinking Diamond Whites and what, and I'll go like, I want a Super Tenants.
Yeah.
The strongest fucking drink, the strongest one. And I couldn't stand the smell of it, the taste of it, but I would open, and I would literally hold my nose and I'd pour it in. And that's how I started really drinking.
Welcome to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scolfor. We are now into season 6, focusing on mental fitness in Britain's construction industry, because historically, these working environments are not conducive to men being able to speak openly about mental health or well-being. And the stats currently stand that construction workers are nearly 4 times more likely to die from suicide than the national average. Today, we've got Neil the Brickie with us. After 5 years of dipping in and out of recovery, Neil finally got sober when he found himself homeless, drunk, and a nuisance to everyone around him whilst living in Spain 20 years ago. The youngest of 3 children, all with different dads, Neil is now a brilliant, engaged father of 2. Neil's simple program that he follows very regularly keeps him in a healthy, successful, sober lifestyle. Neil, welcome to This Is Powerful, mate. Thank you so much for coming here.
Thanks for asking me.
That's all right. I knew you weren't going to work, but you did work, didn't you?
I did.
And chased it from work.
I did. I made it. And I got here on time.
You got in here loads of time, mate.
Cup of tea.
So this is our tradesman and construction worker series.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's really important to give people a voice and for people to hear in that industry what you can do if you have issues and where you can go and et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to ask you, how long have you been sober?
I've been sober coming up for 20 years. 20 wow. years, yes. So it'll be 20 years in July.
That's amazing.
Yeah, in the blink of an eye.
Yeah, it goes quick, right?
It's gone.
It goes really quick. And I start usually like, where are you from? And
I'm from around here, not far from here. Yeah, I'm an East End boy. Yeah, went to school in Bethnal Green.
Did you?
Yeah, born in London Hospital. And yes, I'm a real Cockney.
Yeah.
A real East End.
You don't sound like one.
No.
No.
Essex boy now.
You sound like a posh Cockney.
Posh.
a posh key. and how was your upbringing, Neil, around here?
Upbringing was okay. A lot of mates and stuff. It was tough for my mum with 3 kids and no man in the house.
Whatever, you didn't have really.
Well, no, my dad was there, but not the way I am as a father, or what I think a father should be, the way a father should behave. My dad was... I'm the youngest of 3, so my dad was more of a dad to my brother and sister than their dads were. So even they, they're a bit older, and they said your dad was all right, but he tried, but he had his stuff, his issues, which I can only, because he passed away when I was young, I can only sort of guess what they were. But I know one of them was women. He had a problem with women.
Not so much
a problem, but
he liked the women.
He liked the women.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Problem for others who weren't part of it, basically.
Yeah, problem for maybe other women's husbands, and yeah.
How old are your siblings?
So my brother is 10 years older than me.
Oh, okay.
And my sister is 12 years older than me.
Okay, so quite a gap.
I'm the baby. I just about made it.
How old was you when your dad?
When my dad passed away, I was 15.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
15, yeah. Yeah, it was a tough one.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Very tough, and it's still, it's 30 plus years ago, and it still brings up stuff. Like my wife's uncle passed away recently, we went to the funeral, and it just, death just brings up stuff for me. I think where I experienced it at a young age is sort of, we're not here for a long time.
No.
So it's, and you can sort of say, see you later to someone, and then they're gone.
Yeah, so, but
an early age it's tough. So to cope with the death of my dad, I was already into at 12, 12, 13, I was already having a path, and just the family home was, there wasn't much communication. There wasn't much emotional stuff on the table. It was all under the rug.
Yeah.
And so that's how I grew up, just not talking about stuff. And my dad did actually give me the father and son talk. I got to have that with him. And he said to me, there's nothing wrong with weed and always wear a condom. And that's it, I've got to go to work.
Not while smoking weed, but...
Yeah. And that was, that's what I remember as a father and son talk. And that's what he gave to me. And I think it was because, obviously, weed must have done something for him, relaxed him and whatever else. He was born in Jamaica, so it's part of his...
It's different, it's more of a religion or a spiritual process.
Yeah, it's part of his thing. So there's nothing wrong with weed. And he had... I think at our last camp, possibly 12 kids with different...
Okay.
So always wear a condom.
Didn't relax him that much. Yeah.
But the condom bit is sort of like, that's him going...
Yeah, I've learned something.
Yeah, because he'd come to my house. I used to think he was a caretaker because he had a big bunch of keys. And it was obviously just keys to women's flats. Because he'd just come in and not seen him for 2-3 weeks. And he'd come in and go, all right, how is everything all right, yeah. Me and mum would do him a bit of dinner, and then he'd be sitting there and he'd just go like a rabbit, and he'd go, I've got to go. So it would be one of the kids' birthdays or a football match or something, and this was before mobile phones. So everything was there. And he'd just go like, I've got to go. And he'd just disappear.
Wow.
And then I wouldn't know if I'd see him. I'd see him like 3 days in a row, and then I wouldn't see him for a week, and then I'd see him for 2 weeks in a row, and I wouldn't see him for 3 months.
Did you question it? Was a conversation about
it? Yeah, I'd go to my mum, where's my dad? And she'd go, oh, he's working away. That was it. Mm. That was it. My mum would like discipline me, and I'd say, I want to go and live with my dad. And she'd go, where is he? If you can find him, go and live with him. Because he was very mysterious. He was very sort of like, I think he had a family in Southend. There's 5 boys and a girl in Clapton, somewhere around the corner. He was quite a little businessman from, I think he came over in the Windrush. He was born in 35. So he was born in 1935. So I think he came over Windrushy sort of time. He was always very smartly dressed, immaculately dressed. And he was a businessman and he'd done quite well.
What was his business?
Haulage. He'd done haulage, import, export. And so his first...
That is a good business.
Bro. Yeah. Depending on what you're importing and exporting. But he had real contracts, and he had Kodak and he had Amstrad.
Wow.
So he had good... And he was the first, one of the first ones. He had a tobacco dock. He had a yard, and he turned it into... Someone was moving somewhere and he went, you can store your stuff in my yard. So like a big yellow storage.
Wow.
Before all that stuff, he had one.
And tobacco dock's a bloody good location.
Tobacco dock, brilliant. Before tobacco dock was there, it was the docks. Backed onto the docks. And so I got a lot of memories of running around there as a kid. And he took the person's belongings and put them in the yard. But then he failed to keep the dogs out of him. So the dogs got in, the yard dogs, and ripped all their stuff to bits and done whatever with it. And so it ended up costing him money.
Right.
With the Kodak and Amstrad thing, he had a business partner. And he used to have the money in an account for the tax, for the duty for it to come in. And so he had the money in the account, the shipments coming in, and he thought he'd buy a house without telling his business partner, and flip it over, make some money. And so he didn't know that obviously the way that buying and selling a house goes, it's not sort of not going in the shop and you're going, oh, how much for your house? 200 grand. Oh, there you go.
Here it's 6 months.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the money wasn't in when the shipment came in. Shipment couldn't come in. Kodak gone.
No Amstrad way.
Gone. Business partner gone. So he was sort of. And
how did that affect him? Because that's a big.
That's massive. Yeah. That's massive, and he's only got himself to blame.
Yeah.
People say to me, my uncle and aunt, because my sister say to me that I'm a ringer for my dad, personality. Yeah. That's the sort of shit that I would try and do. I've got a business partner, and I told him that story, and he just went, "Why are you fucking telling me that?" And I went, just to make you aware that just to put you in the picture who you're going into business with, and that I don't do that stuff.
Mm.
Me drinking and taking drugs, I would do that. I would do that. Mm. I wouldn't be in the opportunity to be able to do it, but I would. That's the sort of stuff that I would do. My brain, I'd have a good idea. I think it's a good idea. Don't really turn out to be a good idea. So the yellow storage went, the haulage thing went. But everywhere he went, he had a family and he had a shop. He had a little business. He had a shoe shop in Southend. He had a hair place in Clapton. Wow. He had the thing in Tobacco Dock. So he was a little bit...
Move and shaker.
A little bit of a move and shaker, yeah.
Did you start smoking weed because friends were doing it, or was it because of your dad?
No, it was because of friends. It was because of friends, yeah. I was in Stepney where I was born. And, but as a kid, I didn't like smoking because my nan used to take me on the bus and used to drag me upstairs and you just couldn't see anything and it was just smoke and I'd just go, oh, nan. And she'd take me from Watney Market over to E Street, South London, and we'd go and we'd have McDonald's on Saturday. And I'd go, oh, please, don't want to go upstairs. Don't want to, like, the smoke. I hated the smoke. I hated smoking when I went to Ireland. I hated it. And I love playing football and I love boxing and stuff. And smoking's bad. Smoking's bad for you.
Yeah.
And, I'm 12. Because I've got a memory of being six years old. And the older kids on the estate, they're smoking in the garages, and I remember smoking, like, but just,
yeah.
And they go, "You're not doing it properly." So I go, "What do you like?" And then you go like that, and then you go, and I've done that, and I've coughed my lungs up. Yeah, at 6 years old. And then someone saw me, and they told my brother and sister. They called me. "You've been smoking. We're going to tell mummy. We don't want to see smoking. It's bad for you." 6 years old. I was raised on the streets, really. It's too much for my mum.
I had my first cigarette, which was a Rothmans, at I think 7.
Yeah.
Because I knew I had a little tab with a guy in the corner shop, and the older guys were like, "Oh, Paul, can you get some cigarettes?" And because I wanted to belong with the older guys, I was like, "Yeah, I'll go and get them." Mm. And you could buy one at a time.
Yeah, singles. Yeah. It's mental. And if, like, with having kids now, looking back, I think, how the fuck did I survive? I think ADHD, all that stuff that's undiagnosed now, it was self-soothing. So when I found a puff at sort of 12, I had all the stuff going on. And the puff just... This is hindsight, obviously. The puff just...
Just to be clear for people listening, when you say all the stuff going on, like a busy mind...
Busy mind. Where's my dad? Brother and sister. I've got a white sister. I've got a dark brown brother. And then there's me. And I'm looking, and we don't look like... Are we related? We're right. Brother and sister. So my dad's Jamaican. Yeah, a lot of questions that are just sort of... never asked, and if they are, they're sort of just ignored, just sort of brushed off. Mm. Just like it's a bit of a dark sort of comedy sketch, really, thinking about it. My mum had obviously undiagnosed stuff going on, and so it was just a lot of and I'd go around other people's houses and their mum and dad would be there and be dinner on the kitchen, on the table, nicely decorated and all that stuff, and I just felt a little bit like was the poor kid on the estate with the Harry Enfield sketch with the brown brother and it was sort of like a little bit awkward and but never made to feel like that because of being on a council estate. It's just great. You got I actually walked my son round Salmon's Lane the other day looking at a job, walked him round and I was showing to him what life is like on a council estate. We walked round, his kids playing football, kids climbing up. He lives in Essex in Collier Row.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's just, it's different. Yeah. Nothing wrong with it. It's just different to how I grew up. And I was just showing him the council estate and he was sort of like, "What?" I said, "You call out the window and you call your mate and you go and play football and you're brilliant."
Like a real tight community.
Yeah. So all that sort of stuff going on the estate. So then having a puff, it must have just been quiet, just like, ooh,
yeah,
it's nice.
So it was good. It worked, and
it worked.
Yeah,
it worked, and I stuck to it like glue. That was my first love. Cannabis was my first love. Yeah.
So puffing worked for a while, and that was just. It sounds like just normal childhood.
Yeah, and the
then.
Giggles. You met like. Yeah. Did you ever smoke puff?
I've never touched anything. Never. It's similar with me now. To be honest with you, I smoked originally the same way you described, just because I wanted to belong.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, people were smoking a lot of ash around me.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard, totally out of naivety, that you trip and you hallucinate. And I was so scared of a lot of stuff in life. I was like, I need to be focused. I need to be sharp. So I didn't puff like everyone else did until I was probably 17, maybe later after boxing, because I boxed too.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, why would you smoke? I had an innocent view. I'm like, why would you smoke? Because you need your fucking lung capacity. And I boxed at your call 3 times. Mm. And all the judges on the cigars, you can't, the next day my lungs burnt as a young man.
Passive smoking.
From 15.
That's what I had from my nen. That's my nen's fault.
Exactly, yeah. No, but it's that's the difference. When you experience it and you've got young, fresh lungs, I was like, no, I don't want to do that. I didn't want to drink because I've seen what happens to family members and friends of family members. But, so really when I was about 17, 18, that's when I started to puff and feel the effects of it. And, you know, before I was like, I needed to be up. I needed to be like a wired person.
Yeah.
So it took me a long time to enjoy being calm, personally.
I went in hard with, because I was always with older kids. I would hang about with, older kids. It would be my brother's friend's brothers. And they was all a couple of years older, 2, 3, 4 years older than me. And where I was obviously bouncing off the walls, my mum would go, take him out, get him out the house. And you know, when you go out, and then when you got to come home, when the street lights come on, that sort of, and we'd be around climbing the garages and run outs and all the stuff, football, all the good stuff. And that sort of, looking back again with the puffing, that sort of slowly started dropping off, the boxing, the football. But I do remember puffing and just being it, doing, I'll always be doing more and to impress the other kids, to make the older kids laugh. I'd be doing bucket bongs and fucking chinnums and all that. And I'd go on, we used to call them greenans, but people called whiteys or whatever. Yeah. And I'd just be fucking sweating. I'd lay down on the floor and I'd be going, never again. I'm never touching this again. That's it. Just like cold sweats. And then it's wore off and then I go again. And that's the insanity of it, that it was still, the thought of that happening again still didn't put me off compared to what must have been going on inside here.
Yeah.
Just to get out of my head, get out of my nut. What should we do today? I want to get out of my nut. Why would you say that? Yeah. Why would you fucking say
that's
that?
That's the thing, isn't it? If you say that, you don't like being in it. And I always said it, if you say, like, I want to get out of my head.
But never questioned it, though, as a kid. I never what should we do? Fuck it, don't just get out of my nut. But let's just get, just mad. Yeah. It's mad.
Easy to see in hindsight.
Yeah. But there's a thing, I don't know if you've seen the experiment with, is it Rat Utopia? Have you seen that? You must have seen that. You seen it? And the guy says about, give them something to do.
Yeah.
And they don't touch that.
Yeah.
That stuff.
Because it's about community and connection.
Yeah, connection.
Because when you're out of your nut, you think you're connected, but actually you're on your own.
Yeah, you're on your fucking own.
Yeah.
Yeah. I watched that and I was like, not that it puts a, it doesn't change the way my recovery's gone of like, oh, I didn't really need to go down that route. I could have just done connected or found stuff to do, but because my story is my story. But it did make me think, this geezer's onto something. I don't know his name. I don't know.
That was a famous, famous thing. They've replicated that on many occasions. It's probably,
he's like his cover version of it. Yeah. But it's the first time I saw it and I was like, wow. Yeah.
When you, we'll move on, but I just want to know, when you lost your dad, did your behaviour go down?
What? Yeah, that was it. That was the drinking to numb feelings. Whereas before, drinking had been sort of like with the boys and and a laugh because I was young. Because I was young, I was still at school, and so it would be Bow Cemetery, a few boys, a few girls, puff, drink, like get a tenner off my mum and get a bit of half, and get a couple of cans. And then sort of around that time, well, not even, I would get like, they're all drinking Diamond Whites and what, and I'll go like, I want Super Tenants.
Yeah.
I'm the strongest fucking drink. I'm the strongest one. And I couldn't stand the smell of it, the taste of it, but I would open, and I would literally hold my nose and I'll pour it in. And that's how I started really drinking. I didn't do any, I was just a nuisance in pubs and stuff because I didn't get sort of brought in, you know, like as a dad would bring a son in or an uncle or I sort of learned to be a street, I learned to be a street drinker. I learned how to drink on like park benches and cemeteries and then sort of try to go into a pub and didn't really know how to act.
Yeah.
And I'd get away with it. I got a bit about me, a little bit of personality and I'd be okay for a couple of hours. And then I remember someone saying to me, like a day after being in the pub, Thomas Neal, Watney Market, and I remember someone going to me, you shouldn't drink, mate.
Really?
Yeah. I said, you're a fucking Jekyll. And I thought, what? That's Snide, isn't it? Jekyll and Hyde, Snide. And they meant fucking Dr. Jekyll. This is a totally different person. You and drink don't go well together.
And how did you take that?
I just sort of laughed it off, brushed it off. Because I think it sort of give me, again, hindsight, it give me a freedom to go, I don't give a fuck. I don't care. I don't care about anything. And I say this quite a bit with my thing being, my drinking was like, I'd go to bed like John Wayne. I'd fucking kick the door off. I'd go off. And then I'd wake up like fucking Lois Lane.
Yeah.
And that is it. I'd wake up going, fuck, what did I do? What did I say? What did I... And I'd just... It would be on me. And you, from the literature stuff that I've read of... that's like a common thing of...
I think it's important to say, because we was talking earlier before about working on building sites and working with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And my short experience as a teenager was that I worked with some absolutely insane people.
Yeah.
I mean, crazy stuff. There was funny things like, I remember we was doing floors and they put the resin on the bottom of someone's radio they didn't like, stuck it on a wall so they couldn't get it off, and that tried to do their tyres,
nail their boots to the scaffold and all that stuff.
Feet screwed on there with jit box screws and stuff like that, which is part of finer banter, but there was some really insane stuff. I remember one of the guys getting hammered, and he really didn't like one of the labourers, and he stripped the labourer naked and rolled him in rock wool and threw him in a boiler room for about 3 hours, tied him up, and no one was allowed to go near it.
There's a lot of unhappy people on site because it can.
But the point being is what you're saying is that there's a lot of stuff that goes on inside. So you take like drink alcohol, drugs, whatever, to not feel it, but that never gets remedied, and these things get worse and worse and worse, don't they?
Yeah, progressive. Yeah.
Yeah. Hi, it's Paul here. I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you. And to say, if you've heard something on the show that's moved you, please follow, rate, or review the show, and it'd be amazing if you could share it. Now back to the show.
On site is a lot of, it's tough. It is tough, sink or swim, really, building sites. And it's the same, because I've been on site since I was 15, my dad passed away, school was, hindsight again, they'd be like, are you okay to do your to be at school and to do, do you need any counseling, do you need any help, and I'd just be like, no, I'm all right. Do you want to do your English exam? Not really. My mum would go, are you going to school today? And I maybe subconsciously like, I can do the fuck I want, my dad, because my dad was the disciplinarian, so I'd play up to my mum, and I never knew when my dad was coming in. And she'd be like, your dad's coming in, and I'd be like, fuck shit, please don't tell him that. And she'd give me a squeeze, but he'd just look at me and say, what you been up to? And I'll just go, and then he'd just wait, and I'll just spill everything, I'd do it to my son now, but I try and do it in a loving way rather than, I've not been here for 3 weeks, I need to know what you've been doing. I've been with my son every day, so I know what he's been doing. He's a good boy. He's different to me, and that's okay. That's okay.
So did you go straight into construction?
From that job, I worked on Upper North Street, and my boxing trainer got me a job across the road. So I'd see the teachers going in, like after the 6 weeks holiday, I'm on there. And I go, hey, Mr. Leck, how you doing? You all right? Working. And he goes, well done, Thompson. Well done. We knew you end up there. So it was like, basically I was going to school and going literally across the road from the front gates.
Yeah.
And I loved it. I loved being on site. Apart from one guy, the man in charge was a bully. But I think it's like a temperament tester that young kids have to go through. I'm labouring, I'm cleaning up, I'm a bricklayer apprentice. Cleaning out the rooms, and he'd come over and go, do that room again, you've missed a bit there, and just to see if you're going to go fuck off, or if you're just going to do it. And then he'd go, right, get them loaded out, get that ready, get that rubbish done, and then you can jump on and lay a few bricks. And I'd get that done, I'd get the delivery, I'd get that, and I'd pick up the trowel, go to lay, and he'd go, oh, we need something over there. And I'd literally, and I'd go like that. And then as a young kid, I do remember having visions of, I'm going to get to work early, and I'm going to come up on the scaffold, and I'm going to take a block, and when he comes in, I'm going to throw it on his head. So resentment yeah. is already in me. Resent probably from where's my dad gone and all this stuff building up. But I don't know it. I'm just, well, that's what normal people do, don't you think yeah. about? Normal people think about killing their boss, don't they? And that's just normal. But I wouldn't speak about it. I wouldn't. So I'm going, asking myself, is it normal? I'm going, yeah, of course it's normal. That's well normal.
Yeah. Who would you have asked?
Who do you ask? Yeah. Keys were in the mirror, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Do you think that's head? Because the, you know you can't ask on the site, or you just...
Everyone hated him. So it was probably... I wouldn't ask. The actual thought of doing it was real.
Yeah.
But then between the boys or the men, it would be...
banter.
What do you reckon of him? What do you reckon of him, mate? Yeah. And he's horrible, isn't he? He's fucking horrible. He's a bully. And... He had arthritis, and he was just fucking, he was horrible. I don't know anyone that liked him. And yeah, maybe he had his stuff going on, but he was just
fucking. But it sounds like you had a good mindset in, like, you would do all the stuff, even though you thought about throwing a brick at him.
Yeah.
You'd do your stuff to get on to being a brickie.
Yep. I was having a go. And that first job, like you said, working with, there was nutters on there. That's where I learnt to, that's where... not learnt, but where I went into pubs at lunchtime and they'd have like 4 or 5 pints at lunchtime, half hour. We go to the pub, they'd be in there, be like, I can get back, right, let's clear up and fuck off. And the guy I was working for owned a pub, and it would be Friday, right, come and get your money, come down to my pub, so you go and get your money, and you come back, brilliant, brilliant. He's been sober 30 years now, and I still see him, and yeah.
When did it start to become a problem?
It was a fucking problem from day dot, I think, really. The way with my stuff, it started taking stuff away. But really, it was after my dad passed away. Then it was a little bit, it was drinking to numb, really. And that was, so I'd say around 16, with hindsight. I've met people now that are sort of 16, 17, and like 3 years sober.
That's crazy, isn't it?
It's brilliant. It's fucking brilliant. And I go, how the fuck did you do that? Well, someone took me and I had a little go and I see what they were saying and I didn't have to do. It's like me, when I was 26 when I stopped, and people go, fucking hell, that's brilliant. And it's just getting, it should be in schools. It should be in schools that, especially drink where it's legal and you've got to be a certain age, but then you go, oh, he's going to a party, let him have one. And he's 13, he's 14, and he's thinking. If you're like me, with a puff or with a drink, something that does something for me, I say to my kids, I have to educate my kids. I say, when you're with me, you're not drinking and smoking until you're of age, but you're not with me. You're in school and you're with your mates and you're going to go to parties and you're going to do all this stuff. I suggest that, I suggest you don't touch drugs or alcohol, but it's up to you. If you've got the gene, like me and your mum have got the gene, we've got the gene. We done it and something happened. So I say for them to be able to, someone that they know, because they've never seen me drink or take drugs or smoke or anything. But their Uncle Andy, he's a lovely man. Cigarettes, he cannot put down cigarettes and he hates smoking, but he can't put them down. So I say to my boy, especially because he's the same as me when I was his age, oh, I hate smoking. And when Andy's, oh, I hate getting in his car, all that stuff. I say, Andy smoked when he was young. He had the gene. Nicotine does something for him. And he can't stop it. So it's up to you. You won't switch that gene on if you don't try it.
Smart.
And I don't know. How old is he? He's 11. He's well in front of me.
Yeah.
He's well in front of me at his age. We went out the other week and it was it was a couple of years ago. And it was a sushi thing. He loves sushi. And so when we're out, I go to him, try this, try that. And he goes, Dad, do you like sushi? I went, no, I don't really like sushi. He went, oh, have you ever tried it? And I just went, no. And he went, well, why don't you try it then? And if you don't like it, you don't have to. And that's word for word what I say to him. And I was just like,
he's listening.
All right, smart ass. And I had a bit and I went, that's quite nice. A little roll thing, that's quite nice, yeah. Mm. So he's 11 doing that to me. He's miles in front of me. He outsmarts me all the time. And I just take it. And I go, fucking no, you clever little shit. Yeah.
Where were you at 26?
26, I was homeless, drunk, annoying everyone in Spain.
So how did you get to Spain? When did you go to Spain?
I swam. No, I've got I've got some money from somewhere. I think I got a loan, and I got just anything to get by. I needed some money, and I sort of came to with not a lot of money left and not a lot to show for it. And
Was you already a proper bricklayer by that time?
No, I was a chancer then. I was with me and drink. I'm not functioning. I'm an alcoholic. I call that's what I am. And I'm not functioning. So if I start drinking, I don't know when I'm going to stop. It's not going to be a thing of, I'll have a couple until Friday and I'll probably get on it. If I start on Monday,
you're on it.
I don't know what's happening, yeah. So it got to the stage of losing jobs, relationships, family members. I'm just at 26, I'm a nuisance. I'm a liability. I'm sort of done. 24, really. 24. So I'm done then. So I'm thinking I'm done. I've got to start again. Geographical. Didn't know that I'm going to go to wherever I need to go to. I'm going, oh, fucking, what, I need to get out of here. I've got an aunt and uncle in Spain. That's what I'll do. And I didn't tell him I was coming. I didn't say, oh, is it all right if I pop over? I just fucking went to Spain. But I got a hotel for 2 weeks. And then after 2 weeks, I'm like, after 2 weeks, I'm in. I'm in Stepney in the sun. Same people, same drug dealers, all the same stuff. Get me a bit of work, do this, do that. But they drink all day, every day, because it's sort of acceptable there.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Big measures, and everyone's on the piss. Everyone is on the piss. Like, in my opinion, Spain's got for expats, there's a lot of fucking drink problem.
I've met a lot of expats in different places that's the thing. Yeah.
And so I was like, wow, this is amazing. But after getting away with it for 10 plus years in the East End, people know me and being looked after, and I'll leave. He's harmless, really. He's just a drunk. Oh, his dad died, and oh, he's going through that. Because I'd be like an emotional roller coaster of like 1 minute I'm happy and laughing, singing, telling jokes, and then I'm crying, and I'm smashing something up, and then I'm like, so I was pretty emotionally unstable, really. And in Spain, that became apparent a lot quicker. People were just like, no, he's not right. He's not right. This ain't not right of him. And yeah, they was right. And it was an American woman. I managed to get a bit of painting, seeing a girl. Her boss wanted the villa painted. And I was like, yeah, I can paint the villa. And lunchtime, Monday or Tuesday, whatever day it was, I'll have a beer. Because it was always the thing of, I won't go mad. I'll just have a beer.
Mm.
But without knowing that every time I kicked off something that I couldn't control. I could not control not having the next one. And no matter the consequences, like I said, it would be whatever, job loss or... But so I'm painting this villa, lunchtime, I've gone and had a beer, and then I've turned up sort of Friday and gone to... can I have me wages? Don't have to pay me for when I went for lunchtime. That, you can have that half a day. Like, I'm doing her a favour. You can have that half a day. Just give me the 2 days that I've done. And she just went to me, I want you to paint my villa. I want you to come in on Monday and Tuesday or Wednesday and paint it and get it done. And she just went to me, you do know that you're an alcoholic, didn't you? And I just remember filling up with rage and just going, how dare you just speak to me like that? And this my, the girlfriend at the time is her boss. And so I didn't go any further. Just go like, probably like, fuck off. Yeah, probably a bit of that, but just, yeah. And not long after that, I got sober, and I went, and we was in the company again, and I saw her, and I went, how did you know that? She just nailed me. She nailed me. And I said, how do you know I was an alcoholic? She said, I lived with an alcoholic for 15 years. He couldn't get a day sober. He could not get one day. And so I could just see it in you. I could see it. And... yeah.
So what did you do? You just went to a meeting there, or rehab? Or?
No, so my first ever meeting, I got taken to a meeting at 21 by another girl that I was with. and so it sort of like gravitates with children of alcoholics and that sort of stuff, you know, like, because the girls within Spain, dad's an alcoholic.
Mm.
The girl that whose dad took me to a meeting, alcoholic. And so, yeah, there's definitely a gravitational pull with kids of alcoholic, I think.
I think there is. I think you're tuning in energetically.
Yes.
It's like a little dance.
Yeah.
They try to fix you and you're trying to...
run away. And and it's the atoms, isn't it? And then when you obviously meet each other, the spinny, like, I don't know if you've ever read Celestine Prophecy, like the real energy and we're all buzzing around each other. And we're just... So I've got a best mate, the same thing. We met in school, we had a puff together and we could just sit in silence. I'm best man at his wedding, he's best man at my wedding 35 years later. We can just sit like that and we can talk, we can buzz. We're on the same frequency is the word I'm looking for. And so I got taken to my first meeting at 21 and it was in St. Clement's where I used to, Bow Cemetery. So I'm thinking, I used to drink round here and what's he taking me to this place for? What's it about? And I remember going in there and I just remember feeling really young. And everyone was Scottish and Irish and they were smoking in there. Same thing as the bus. I was like, fucking, I'm on the bus again. and I don't remember what was said. The weekend before, I just misbehaved. And my girlfriend's dad was like, I want you to come somewhere with me. I want to take you somewhere. So he took me to a meeting. And I don't remember anything that was said, but I remember sitting there and someone said something behind me, and I don't even know what it was, but a tear literally just went, poof, it fucking jumped out my eye. It went right. And I was like, what was that? It was identification. Whatever they'd said, whether it was about family or it was about crashing a car or whatever it was, a seed was planted, and I was like, fuck. That was at 21. So going on from then, when I fucked stuff up, I'd go to these meetings. There's something in these meetings. And I'd go back sporadically and someone would be talking about a washing machine and a washing machine head and how they managed to do light. And I just didn't get... No one's talking about drinking. I think, why are people not talking about... what's going on with drinking? I'm not getting it. They're talking about how they feel. What's that got to do with... I've got a drink problem. I drink, things go wrong. Stop drinking. If I can stop drinking, things will be okay. And I fucking believed that. I really believed it. And so it was just a case of my life getting worse and worse. Situations happening and then ending up in Spain. So sporadically going to meetings, maybe getting a week sober, 2 weeks sober, a month sober, thinking I'm fixed. I can have one. It's been a month now and the same thing happening. So that sort of cycle for 5 years basically, but an ever decreasing circle of it's getting worse. It's getting worse. And and then going to Spain, going to a meeting and just basically just being at the end, being broken and going, I don't know what to do. Do you know how do I stop drinking? Asking someone. And that was it. That was the beginning. I thought it was the end, going to meetings and not drinking.
That's the thing people think, though. It's like...
my life's over.
Your life's over. But I always thought as well, like, oh, I can stop, I can handle this because you have a little bit of time off. And it's a really weird process of denial to know how bad you really are. Even if you've still got a nice house, nice car. It's nothing to do with it, is it? The drinking and the inside stuff.
Well, this is the thing. Where I'm a fucking low bottom sort of non-functioning alcoholic, it's a lot easier for me. You think it would be a lot easier for me to see, even though I was just, denial was there and I'm just like, you know, I'm fine. I'm fucking homeless. Like, I'm at the bottom.
Yeah.
So it's just an opinion that I have that people that have managed to put a decent life together, like I said, the guy that I started work with had built a massive business and he had like properties abroad and a few properties in England and a pub and money falling. So how can you tell someone your life's unmanageable and you just go, I've got three cars outside. And his wife would go, you've got a problem. And he goes, what problem have I got? My problem's you. You're my problem. I've got no problem. It ended up in the same place.
Yeah.
But just a lot later on, and a lot more damage done to family and children and business,
yeah,
and all that stuff that I didn't have. So I think it, in my opinion, it's easier. It was easier for me. If I had trappings, I'm not really stopping until I had to go until everything's gone, and I didn't have a lot to lose.
That's so a sad thing though, because if you did have a lot, it would take you a lot longer, wouldn't it?
And I've seen, I've been in meetings for a long time and see people coming broken at like in their 60s, in their 70s, and going, what the fuck happened? What's happened?
Mm.
And they've drunk it away, the family and the thing. And but that's when they're supposed to get there. Everyone gets there.
When did you realise you was like, sobriety's for me?
Very early. Really early in. Really early in. It was in Spain. It's the thing of the expat community in AA and the expat community. So just like one of us. And yeah, I just got kidnapped. Basically, I just got kidnapped. That guy that when I said I went to the meeting. So I got told about the yets. I got told, have you hit your girlfriend yet? Have you crashed your car yet? Have you? And I'm like, I'm not that bad. I'm not that bad. And I went back to that meeting a week or two later, and I'd crashed my car and hit my girlfriend. There's something that was, that to me was like, the guy that 12-stepped me, took me to my meeting, he said, I hit my wife and all that stuff, and I pissed the bed, trying to get me to identify, and I just remember, how can you hit a woman? Pissed the bed, why are you telling me that? But I'm pissing in wardrobes. I'm pissing in drawers, out my night, like, don't know what I'm doing. And then so when I hit my girlfriend in Spain, I said to her, I was doing whatever, and she was attacking me. And as she come towards me, I kicked her. And then the next day, she had a big bruise on her arm, massive bruise. And she said, you kicked me? And I said, I didn't kick you. You attacked me, and I pushed you away with my leg. I didn't kick you. Like just the level of my brain trying to trick myself into, you are now someone who you said you'd never be.
Yeah.
And he's still trying to go to me, you didn't kick her, you pushed her away. I kicked her. And so I went back to this meeting. I said to the guy, how did you know? You said about car crashes and kicking. How did you know I was going to do that? Like a fortune teller. And he went, that's what we do. We say we're not going to do this. I'm never going to do it again. And we do. And we changed the goalpost. And said, I didn't kick you, I pushed you with my foot. So early sobriety was just brilliant. Kidnapped, taken to meetings, the most important person in the room, the newcomer, Neil, say hello to him, give him your phone number. And like a week later, the most important person in the room, John. I'm like, what? What about me?
Where's my title?
What happened to... Yeah, you're in, mate. You're an old timer. Go and tell John what it's like to be sober for a week. Brilliant. And then and I've just continued to get a bit served. Put some chairs out. It's not about what you can get out of recovery. What can you put in?
What is it you saw for people who don't know in recovery that kept you coming back? What was the benefits, basically?
We spoke about Acorn House. And when I got sober, and with my living situation and work situation in Spain, like to come back to England, I was very fearful of coming back to England, and people in AA just give me some brilliant advice. Just go to meetings, get a sponsor. The same stuff that I say, exactly word for word, what I say to anyone that's new. And they go, you told me that the last time I saw you. And I go, yeah, because it just ain't changed.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed. Go get a home group, get a sponsor, get some service, think of others, try and help other people. If you're thinking of someone else, you're not thinking about yourself. So simple. It's such a beautiful, simple program. So I came back to England. The woman that told me about getting a sponsor, she said, I suggest you go to a meeting, close your eyes and listen. Don't look for someone who's got what you want. Because she went, when you think of a sponsor, who would you fit? And I said, oh, Chris, he's got loads of money. Cracking girlfriend, convertible Beamer. He could be my sponsor. And she went, don't work like that. So she said, go to a meeting, close your eyes and listen. And I went to Shoreditch. I went to the meeting there. It was on a Thursday. I met a woman in there who I'd met in Spain, in AA. I won't say her name, that I still see. Beautiful, lovely woman who's who just give me, who was just so kind. And I sat in there and I closed my eyes, and someone started sharing, and I just remember like nodding and talking about the pubs when the doors open, the laughter, and looking in, and the men counting money and with the girls and all the stuff, and I just identified with what he was saying, and I just thought, I'm going to ask him to be my sponsor. What he said is me. And then the meeting's done, and I've just turned round and I've gone, that can't be him. He can't be my sponsor. He looks like, nah, he's got glasses and he's got rubbish trainers. Nah, he can't be my sponsor. Do you know all the sort of,
but that just shows
where,
life before is measuring on the outside of material things and what you think things should be.
But the material side of it, and just thinking that it wasn't about what before. He was the best thing. He's the best thing I've ever heard someone say, the most I've ever identified. But then with my eyes, I go, oh no, this can't be right. But something overrid my brain, and I said to, and he says that you come up to me like Tigger. He says you come up to me like Tigger. I was just bantered. Do you reckon you can help me? Do you reckon we can go? And he's just going, calm down a bit. Give us your number. We'll go and have a cup of coffee and we'll have a chat. And he's been my sponsor for 20 years. Brilliant.
That's amazing.
Brilliant, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And he got sober at 26 as well.
Oh, really?
So I've got him to, he was 40. He was 40 years sober the other day. And I say, he wouldn't have got there without me, mate. And he goes, fucking hell. I know it as well.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
What do you do for yourself now for mental well-being and stuff?
For mental well-being, what do? I like to, if my wife's ever going to watch this, she's sent me a thing off of, I don't know, one of the reels, TikTok or something, when the guy goes, I'm not going to do too much. He's a northerner. We watch it and we piss ourselves. I'm not going to do too... I know you want me to do it, but I'm not going to do too much. So I don't try to do too much. I try not to do too much. I like spending time with my kids. It's probably my favourite thing. For myself, what do I do for myself? I like listening to music. I love listening to music. I keep threatening to go to the gym. I go to meetings. I got a couple of friends. I just like to keep things really simple.
Yeah.
Like really simple.
Do you do any meditation or anything on that line?
I can just sit. So this annoys my mother-in-law. I can just sit or lay or whatever, and I can just look at nothing, like that wall up there, and I can just sit and look, and my mother-in-law will go, she will look at what I'm looking at. It doesn't matter, it could be this, it could be anything, and I can just look at it like that, and I'm thinking of absolutely nothing, and she'll come over my shoulder, or she'll just go, what are you looking at? I go, ceiling. She's looking at the ceiling, and she'll go, you're fucking mad. If you'd met me 20 years ago, you could have said that, but that's my madness. I'm just... Yeah, am I meditating? I don't know. I'm just looking.
But it sounds incredible, because going from a young man having a really busy mind, having to puff or drink for it to go,
to be able to sit still is fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
It's absolutely brilliant. I'm just go like that, and she don't get it. My wife's mum is ADHD on speed.
Yeah,
cannot sit down. Just cannot stay still. And she's always around.
So how do you deal with stress on sites and stress at work? Because that's the thing that I think a lot of people don't know how to handle.
Yeah. So I've got, like I said, I've got a business partner, and I've got a program that he's got an inbuilt one. My business partner's got an inbuilt program. We was talking, we've started getting contractors in, and they're working for us. We've never done it before. We work for ourselves and we stick to what we know. But to do the roof and to do the internals, we've called someone else in. We've had to organise scaffolding. So we're getting busy. And it's he's started businesses before with people. It's not worked. I've done the same before with people. It's not worked. We're not best pals. I can't let what I'm doing be the be all and end all of my mental well-being.
Yeah.
That, like, it's, the business is going really well. It's going really well. But it's just a small part of my life.
Yeah.
And to allow me to do other things.
Which is balance, basically.
Trying to get a balance. Yeah. Trying to get a balance.
Like we was talking about in the beginning about resentments for mm-hmm. people. Yeah. It's hard. I can pick up resentments quite a lot.
Yeah.
When someone's unaware of something or they've done something to me.
Said something and you took it personally.
That's when I have to take myself away for a minute, make a phone call. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean, like in that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll get you. Yes, I've done that. Yeah, I've done that quite a few times. He's highly strung. But he's also got an inbuilt program where the resentment doesn't last. It's like, right, whatever it is, I'm just a bit more careful with words. I think once you've said something, you can't really unsay it. So I don't really want to go down the road. Well, you do and you do it. So he's maybe a bit more emotional where I'm sort of no better, no worse, just different.
Yeah.
Just different. Confrontation doesn't do me any favours. Really doesn't. And but I'll try and...
Outside of use too, do you have to have, do you have people around you? Like, say, if you're building a house.
Yeah, but we've got people that we got people that we know, that we've known for a long time and stuff. And, yeah, maybe things get said in front of people. And yeah, all it is me being super sensitive. That's what... So it comes down to what I've learned in the programme is disregard the other person. Yeah. What did you do? What did you say? Yeah, I'm powerless. So having that thing of being totally powerless over people, places, things, sets me up in a good position. Doesn't always work. It doesn't always not forefront of my mind.
Which basically means you ain't taking things personal. You have empathy that they might have something going on.
Yeah,
so you can let it go.
I try.
Yeah.
I do try. And listen, he's fantastic at what he does. And I suppose, if we're going to get a job, I'm more of the, hello, mate, how's the family? How's the kids then? And he's more like, right, what we've got to do is we need to be up to here by the first week, and this needs to be, and this drawing here is, this needs amending.
So it's
and
a
this
good balance.
It works. I've never had it so good, work-wise, and I don't think he has either. And something has come together, something works.
Yeah.
And the people that work with us and for us, we're like polar opposites. We're our polar opposites. So he'll go, right, what should we do now? And I'll go, let's go to the caf. And he'll go, no. Let's go up there and fucking build that thing there. Yeah. And I'll go, all right. Yeah, so, and I'm not in charge. And he's not in charge. But he's more in charge than me.
Yeah.
And I'm fucking happy with that. I'm over the moon. Because I'm my dad. So financially, I'm a gambler and I'll do all that stuff. And I'll just, he just goes, "What? How are you so relaxed about it? You're not worried about this. You're not thinking what's going to happen." And I go, "If I keep it in the day." And he goes, "What do you mean keep it in the fucking day? We've got a book working for now." I go, "Oh, yeah, I know. It'll be all right."
It sounds like it's good because you just get on with what you're doing as you're supposed to do it. And he probably oversees.
Yeah.
Schedules
he's
and stuff.
He's called Brains.
Yeah.
We call him Brains.
Perfect.
Yeah, it works. It does work. Yeah.
One last question. Now, if someone's on a site,
right,
whether they're a plasterer, painter, floor layer, whatever they're doing, and they were suffering like you were with resentments, the thinking, maybe they're already drinking and using and stuff, what would you suggest they do?
Man, I'll put myself back into that position. Talk to someone. That is the thing. If you keep whatever you keep to yourself, people go to me, "Are you all right?" And I go, "Yeah, I'm all right." But my brain is, and it takes courage, and it takes a perfect storm, in my opinion, to let it out, to just get to the point of where enough's enough. Sick and tired of being sick and tired?
Obviously, just you can't talk to anyone though. So what would you do on the building site? Like, where would you go with that?
Building site, where do you go? I'm a believer in my anonymity. Everyone knows I don't drink. But yeah, there's so many people in recovery now. There's so many people not drinking that, I mean, obviously you can go to the the they've all got mental health people on site now. They've got the doctors and they've got the stuff.
Oh, okay.
And you can go into the main office and but if you want to be one of the workers, go to one of the workers, go to your line manager, your foreman, and they'll know there'll be someone on site who don't drink.
Yeah.
Guaranteed who don't drink, but and that's it, there. You're in.
Lovely. Neil, thank you very much.
Our top man.
Thank you very much. This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation UK, which educates the public about addiction, recovery, and the wealth of surrounding issues. We use lived experience and evidence-based science to support those in recovery and those struggling with addiction. To find out more about what we do, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com. You can also donate, please donate. It really, really helps us to put this on for you guys. It will help us to break the stigma of addiction. It will also help us to educate more of the population, and it will allow us to bring you more episodes. Thank you. See you next time.